So, I am very adept at spotting mistakes, primarily grammatical mistakes, in other people's writing. However, when it comes to my own speaking, especially in that kind of on-the-fly style in interviews or discussion, I make a lot of grammatical speaking mistakes, and this podcast is an excellent example of that. Now, I might have fixed a couple, but there should be like 7 or 8 pretty noticeable ones left. You know, I subject-verb agreement, tense errors, I'm known to dangle a participle here and there. So here's a little contest, because I'm trying to get 15 orders for T-shirts. If you can send an email to brett@schoolsucksproject.com with a list of at least 5 errors that you spotted in this show, the very first person to do it, and only the first person to do it, free T-shirt. How about that? If you, you know, listen to the show with a pen and paper handy, try it out. It helps me learn. It's good for me to hear about these mistakes from other people, and it'll help keep your editorial skills sharp. So I really would like to improve that a little bit and be more conscious of that. And you know what? Maybe that's why in the education category on Podomatic.com, School Sucks Podcast is in second place behind a show that's all about learning how to speak good. Anyway, that's it for today. I hope you enjoy this. It is Kids Are Not Defective, Part 9. Relationships, Conformity, and Convenience.
He wasn't there when I needed him. No, he was never around. His reputation was preceding him, and he was out on the town.
Alvy, you're the one who never wanted to make a real commitment. You don't think I'm smart enough. We had that argument just last month, but don't you remember that day? I'm home.
Oh, yeah? How'd it go?
Oh, it was really weird, but she's a very nice woman. Yeah. And I didn't have to lie down on the couch, Alvy. She had me sitting up. So I told her about the family and about my feelings towards men and about my relationship with my brother. And then she mentioned penis envy. Do you know about that?
Me? I'm one of the few males who suffers from that. So you know, go on.
Well, she said that I was very guilty about my impulses towards marriage and children. Mm-hmm. And then I remembered when I was a kid how I accidentally saw my parents making love.
Really? All this happened the first hour?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I've been home for 15 years. I have nothing like that.
I told her my dream, and then I cried.
You cried? I have never once cried. It's been fantastic to me. I whine. I sit my...
Well, anyway, Alvy, in my dream, Frank Sinatra is holding his pillow across my face, and I can't breathe.
Sinatra?
Yeah, it's strangling me, and I can't...
No,
you know,
kidding. Just... Well, sure, because he's a singer, and you're a singer, you know, so it's perfect. So you're trying to suffocate yourself. It makes perfect sense. It's a perfect analytic kind of insight.
She said your name was Alvy Singer.
What do you mean? Me?
Yeah, you. Because in the dream, I break Sinatra's glasses.
Sinatra had glasses? You never said Sinatra had glasses. What are you saying? That I'm suffocating you?
Oh, and God, Alvy, I did this really terrible thing to him. Because then when he sang, it was in this real high-pitched voice.
So, what did the doctor say?
Well, she said that I should probably come 5 times a week. And you know something? I don't think I mind analysis at all. The only question is will it change my wife?
Will it change your wife?
Will it change my life?
Yeah, but you said, will it change my wife?
No, I didn't. I said, will it change my life, Alvy?
You said, will it change my wife? You said,
life. I said life.
She said, will it change my wife? You heard that because you were there, so I'm not crazy.
And Alvy, and then I told her about how I didn't think you'd ever really take me seriously because you don't think that I'm smart enough.
Why do you always bring that up? Because I encourage you to take adult education courses? I think it's a wonderful thing. You meet wonderful, interesting professors. Adult education is such junk. The professors are so phony. How can you do it?
I don't care what you say about David. He's a perfectly
David.
Fine teacher.
David,
and what are you doing following me around for anyway?
What's following you and David?
Call this relationship quit.
That's fine. That's great. Well, I don't know what I did wrong. I mean, I can't believe this. Somewhere she cooled off to me. Is it something that I did?
Never something you do. That's how people are. Love fades.
Love fades. God, that's a depressing thought. I have to ask you a question. Don't go any further. With your wife in bed, does she need some kind of artificial stimulation like marijuana?
We use a large vibrating egg.
Large vibrating egg. Well, I ask a psychopath, I get that kind of an answer. Jesus, here, you look like a very happy couple. Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah? So how do you account for it?
I'm very shallow and empty, and I have no ideas and nothing interesting to say.
And I'm exactly the same way.
Ah, I see. Well, that's very interesting. So you've managed to work out something, huh?
Right.
Oh.
Hit it!
Hello.
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 Wow, that was so nice.
That was so easy.
Right, we have no intro. We have no intro, so we're going to wing the intro here.
We have no plan about how we're going to do an intro, but that's okay.
This is Mike.
And this is Stephanie.
And this is Brett.
Yes, and we're Pork Sucks, right? We're School Porks.
School Porks. Yeah, that could be taken in other ways. We are Pork Therapy and...
School Sucks Podcast.
Yes, teaming up for a super fun evening of awesomeness.
All together. This is the first time I have ever done a show with other people where I was actually...
With them.
With them. Like,
wow.
Looking at them.
Yeah. This is quite an honor. And, well, I guess we didn't really have a plan about how to introduce ourselves, but just because we have probably two different audiences and we've never heard about each other before, I guess we should say a little bit about School Sucks.
Yes.
And a little bit about Pork Therapy.
Right.
Sure. I'll start if you want.
Yes.
School Sucks Podcast is a show that covers the problems with the government education system. And
it's actually about the end of public education.
Yes, hopefully. We'd like to get there. But we've spent a lot of time looking at some of the hidden lessons of school, how individualism is destroyed by the education system, and how the government itself is built up, sort of this large fantasy of the great government. And now this show for me that I'm going to be putting onto my podcast feed is part of a series called Kids Are Not Defective, which deals with some of the more subtle aspects of things that we learn in school.
Yes, and it's a cool podcast. Personally, I think we're going to be getting a lot more listeners from the School Sucks audience than
you are from ours.
Brett is going to be getting.
Although
from
we've mentioned
ours.
School Sucks on a number of episodes.
Oh yeah, we
really?
Absolutely
yes.
have.
Thank you.
Yep, we plug you every chance we get.
Cool. So, how would you describe Pork Therapy?
Did not sound as dirty as it. Anyway, so Pork Therapy is a show about relationships, and it's about how to interact with people in a voluntary society, right? And so we talk about things like persuasion and communication. And not calling the cops or running to an authority figure every time you have
a
interpersonal problem.
And communication, in case we haven't mentioned that.
Yes, communication is key. But but yeah, it's basically about relationships in the context of a voluntary society. And that's pretty much all we can say about it for now.
You can find us on the web at porktherapy.com. That's P-O-R-C.
And you can find our show at schoolsucksproject.com.
Yes, and
right.
please check them out, even though Brett's audience is a lot bigger than ours. In case you haven't heard of it, in case you've been living under a rock and you haven't heard of School Sucks, you should definitely go and check it out, because he's got a lot of cool features there, including the forum and all kinds of episodes.
Yes, go please download it, and get on our forums, too. We could use some new life there, I would say.
Oh. Mm,
new life, fresh
so
blood.
So why are we meeting tonight?
We are going to talk about romantic relationships, and maybe we can broaden that to interpersonal relationships in general, but I thought this was something that I hadn't covered in any real detail. I had tried a couple times and wound up editing those segments out of the show because they were just too cloudy and long-winded, so...
Now
we're going to try it with two more people.
Yeah,
we'll see how that goes.
If you're coming here to not
people.
Be long-winded, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
We'll give it a shot.
We have about the longest wind in the business, I would have to say.
It's not the size of the wind that matters. Okay.
Right.
So
right.
I guess the opening question, and this was primarily what I wanted to explore, is even though I believe that lots of the things that shape who we are in negative ways as they relate to our interpersonal interactions, and especially our romantic relationships, probably originate in family, but a lot of these problems are very much exacerbated by our experience in 12 years of public school or any kind of forced environment. Because when you're mm-hmm. under 18, any environment that you're in is a forced environment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you've talked about on your show before how that contributes to things like bullying and the way that kids treat each other,
mm-hmm.
you know, when they're forced to spend 7 hours a day with people that they wouldn't normally associate with, well, right. that's probably going to create some problems. And they're also in an environment where they're being forced to do everything, and
they don't want to be there. They don't want to learn what they're being forced to learn.
Right.
They don't want to associate with those people they're forced to associate with.
Yeah, how could that end up good?
Yeah.
No, it never does. It's school is right there with prison and the military, as far as...
And it's not that different from prison, actually.
No.
Yeah.
They have the same architectural designers sometimes.
Yes, that's true.
And that's not all, that's in common.
That's true.
Yeah, that certainly is how I remember my... I went to government school, unfortunately, and that's how I remember my education feeling. I mean, I just remember every day waking up and thinking, wow, today's going to really suck. And just thinking, pretty soon I'll be old enough to get away from this, and I just can't wait for that to happen.
And then you chose to go to medical school.
Well, it's because I want to help people, and how am I supposed to be a doctor if I don't get an education? But anyway...
That is one that would be a tricky job to pull off without any higher education.
Yeah.
So, because I'm kind of I've gotten cold on the whole college thing for a lot of people. Just when you think about the amount of debt that people have to incur, you really need to know what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to really weigh whether college is going to help you
with
that goal.
Exactly. So I was thinking there seems to be, in addition to all of the lessons that I've talked about on the show. In the past, I think there seems to be a trio that applies specifically to the relationships that we have as adults or even as adolescents. I think they can show up that soon. And the idea is that we're trained in conformity from a very, very young age, and that's virtuous to conform and to follow directions.
Mm-hmm.
And that conformity grows up. So I think that the first thing that we learn is that people are very, very malleable. That's what we're told in school, because from the time we enter school till the time we graduate, we are being told to change. At home and at school, we change for our peers. We fit ourselves into cliques. And, of course, the whole school environment itself is just like, do this, do this, do this. Don't show that. Don't show this.
Yeah.
This is what you need to be.
Don't be smart. Don't dress differently. You know, don't act weird. I don't even know how else to describe it. Just be like everyone else.
I would say if a child doesn't, or a young person doesn't actively notice that other people are malleable, or are being trained to be malleable, that is their first person experience, because everything that they're experiencing in government school is trying to change them. It's trying to dumb them down. It's trying to slow them down. It's trying to make them learn things they don't want to learn. Just their own personal experience is, everything around me is trying to change me, so that must be true of everyone.
Right.
So even if you don't actively notice, these people are changing, you notice, I am, so everyone must be.
Right, right, okay. Exactly.
I don't think I said that well, but...
No, absolutely, absolutely. I totally agree with that. So we can go through the lessons, and then I think we can talk about maybe how they show up a little bit later on.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the second one would be that your emotions don't need to be expressed. Like, you have very little say in a lot of the things that happen to you at home when you're little, and a lot of the things that happen to you at school all the way up until you graduate. So there isn't really any forum where teachers or principals or even parents are looking for, like, feedback. Like, how am I doing?
Are you
satisfied with this whole experience? Here's a questionnaire. Here's a suggestion box. That never happens. And I think, we were talking before we started about, because we don't have any practice expressing our emotions when we're little, a lot of times they don't, or even, up through high school, a lot of times when they finally show up for somebody else to see, they've been kind of bubbling and building up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time something finally bursts out, it's usually something that is... worthy of punishment as far as the authorities are concerned. So the subtle message there is don't have emotions, because this is the result.
Emotions are bad.
Right, exactly.
At least it's bad to express them, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, but he's saying even when you don't express, I mean, this is, I think, the nature of a human. If you don't express your emotions, it's going to build up and you will not be able to help it sooner or later. Mm-hmm. And then they will come out in a way that you can't control. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's kind of the... people just blow their top.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Basically.
So I think there's two facets to that. And one is exactly what you mentioned, and the other is that it just builds a habit. When you're trained not to talk about your emotions, not to express anything, not to... When that's what is expected of you as a child, and all throughout these 12 years of indoctrination, you're just used to it. You're just used to... You've got a habit now of not expressing emotions. Right. So that's another... You know, it's attacking you at two fronts in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about spending 35 hours a week in environments where it would just be so inappropriate to say, I feel this right now.
Yeah.
What can we do about that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then, yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, it goes on beyond that environment as well. And you think about the social interactions that school very much creates as far as cliques are concerned. There's not a lot of opportunity to practice expressing emotions or feelings in a genuine way. So I think what you're saying is absolutely right. Yeah, it just gets buried. And sooner or later, that blows. Yeah.
Okay.
In more ways than one. 3, we are trained to pay attention to words and not deeds. And this starts with, we look at the founding of the country, the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, right? So we pay attention to words like freedom and liberty and justice, but we don't look at the deeds of those people.
Boy, that's no accident. I mean, I don't like the conspiracy that government, you know, does everything to control people. Mm-hmm. It's, in my opinion, it's... chaos out of order. It's just the way it developed, the way it evolved. But it's no accident that you're taught throughout your childhood and as you're growing into a person to do that. Because what would the government do if everyone
paid attention to deeds?
Yes,
and saw how
paid attention to the government's own deeds instead of the government's own words. Yeah. I mean, just to hide what the government alone does. That's a prime lesson.
Right, like they talk about freedom and they're actually bombing people.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Didn't Obama get the Nobel Peace Prize while we were in an unconstitutional war.
Yeah.
That was accelerating at that time.
Right, yeah. And still, right.
So this was something that I covered on the show recently, the virtue of rebellion. You know, for the founding fathers, against oppression and against unjust taxation. But as soon as they had the position of authority, it was like, oh, yeah, you can't do that. That's not okay anymore.
That's right.
Now we march against you when you do that. No, no more virtue there. So, yeah, it's very much about words and not deeds. Because, people who have that power, I think they know that, sure, our thoughts become our words all the time, mm-hmm. but our words also have that way of becoming our thoughts. Mm. So you stick to the words,
and your thoughts will be confined.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think it's more the more important idea here is words over deeds, or don't question? Because even if a student was taught all these words, which are essentially hypocritical, if they question them, they'll learn a lesson. If there's a conversation that ensues, right?
Go ahead.
No, that's it. That's my question.
I think it's more about a kind of intellectual laziness or passivity, where if we're only taught to pay attention to what people say, we don't take that to the next step and say, okay, now I want to look for empirical evidence that backs those words up. They just say, oh, yeah.
He said it. It's got to be true. I read it on the internet. It's true.
Mm-hmm. And then that one is kind of a tricky one is how it translates to relationships, but I think it does in a big way.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, any other thoughts on those three things? Disagreements, additional...
No. Those are huge. I have no idea if there's more facets that would occur to me.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah. But I am anxious to talk about how this affects relationships as an adult.
All right. Then let's do the first one, then. Okay. People are malleable.
Okay.
People mm-hmm. can be changed.
Yeah. It's so often that people try to change each other within the context of relationships.
I would say that some people even seek a relationship partner, a love or interest or whatever, with the hope of being able to change them, like it's a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or like it's flip this house.
Yeah. flip this boyfriend.
Well, that almost kind of goes into the concept of serial monogamy that we were discussing before. And people sort of just move from partner to partner because for whatever reason. They feel unfulfilled. They feel that they're looking and searching for this mythical one person that's going to complete them and that's going to change all of the bad aspects of their personality into good and erase all their flaws. And when they meet this person, it'll be magic. And it's this romanticized kind of fairy tale that isn't really true in real life. I mean, you can't, if you perceive flaws within yourself, meeting another person is not going to erase those flaws, you know.
I would, you have anything?
Oh, go ahead.
I would say that if you have spent, what age does a person start government school? Four? Five?
Five. Yeah.
So let's say the 12 years of your life after 5 years old, and probably a little bit before, when you're in this indoctrination center, you're becoming a person, and you've grown a habit of being malleable and accepting that everyone is malleable, like you said, then it kind of makes sense that when you're 18, when you're 25 or whatever, and you're looking for a significant other, a love interest, you're just going to accept that they're going to change. Everyone is malleable, so you accept, you know what, this person doesn't really match my values, I don't love them a lot, but I'm sure I will. I'm sure I can change them.
Mm-hmm.
I may not be happy now, but I'm sure I can make it happen. Is that that kind of thing what you're looking at?
Yeah, it's kind of a strange desperation, too, yeah. And it's kind of a really far-fetched idea. And it goes back to what you were saying, too, Stephanie, about serial monogamy. Why are these people so afraid to be alone? That they have to jumping from it? Why do they need somebody like that? What do you think about that?
Because some people's self-esteem is so integrated with the idea of having a partner that they're just terrified. They've been taught to feel like it's the worst thing in the world to be alone. And if nobody wants you, then all of your fears about yourself must be true.
I agree with that, but that has more to do with conformity, wouldn't you say?
It has a lot to do with another lesson of school, which is dependence.
Oh,
dependence.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you are helpless, you know, until you are. I mean, nature starts telling you that you're an adult long before adults start telling you you're an adult.
Yeah.
That's true.
And that raises a conflict in personal relationships between the parents. Because the child or the young person might know how they want to live their life or do certain things, and the parent says, well, you're only this age, you can't do that.
Right, right.
I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. I think that there's a lot of frustration that comes with that, though. When you see yourself, like when we're little, yeah, adults cook us food and they drive us places and it's friggin' amazing.
They pay for everything.
But when we're the same size as them and we can do most of the same things and we're dating and we can drive a car and we can legally have a job, they're not so impressive anymore. So, there's also the thing where it's like we can start to see that world. So while there's this light at the end of the tunnel that isn't there maybe when we're in middle school, which is just like, oh, worst time, the worst time of life, where you're just a worksheet slave, you know, trudging home with a 40-pound backpack to fill out more worksheets. Same thing you did all day, but that's just like buried in a mine. That's
right.
What that must just that kind of hopeless feeling. But we can see the light at the end of the tunnel in high school. Now I think that's a good thing, but it's also frustrating.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that almost makes it worse because you know, as a child that. Or as a young adult, that you're capable of doing certain things and you're capable of basically managing your own life. But yet everyone around you is constantly underestimating you and telling you that you're not capable of doing certain things. And what recourse do you have against that? None, really.
And in a lot of cases, you're not permitted to take care of yourself by the government or by your parents because of the cultural norms or because of whatever they went through as a kid or whatever. Right? You're not allowed to go get your own apartment at 17 and live on your own, right?
Right, exactly. So we're told that we're unreasonable, right? If we think about the things that can define us as an individual, as we start trying to emerge into these adult selves, reason, right? Like, my mind is worthy of thinking. Yeah, you don't have that. You're not, no.
You can't think, you're just 17.
You're unreasonable. No, it's not always that overt, but if you look at the aggregate of all of those little messages and little insults, it does come out that way in the end. Purpose. You don't have any purpose. You go there. You come out, the bell will ring at the end of the day. That's when you can leave.
Because somebody tells you that's what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You don't have your own reason for wanting to go there. You don't even want to be there. Mm-hmm. You're just doing it because you have to.
Right.
Or else there'll be consequences.
And then we have self-esteem.
That's huge. That, and I think that also relates to the serial monogamy issue.
Mm-hmm.
No self-esteem. I can't do things on my own. I'm not worth something unless someone is with me or loves me or is having sex with me. Self-esteem, I think, is huge.
Right.
And it's drilled out of you in school, would you say?
Well, I think it's something that really has to be... that's a difficult question. I don't know if it's something that is, like, innate. I think it's something that we have to build, or something that we kind of have to maybe discover, right? Because a lot of people are saying, I'll feel good about myself when I weigh this much, mm-hmm. or I'll feel good about myself when I achieve this, right? And they won't feel good about themselves right now.
Okay.
So I think it's something that has to be
interesting
discovered instead of something that has to be attained, because people always just keep moving the bar higher and higher, and they'll never have it. So I think this is more about, you know, a process of self-discovery that will lead to self-understanding and that leads to self-esteem. I don't think it's like, once I achieve these things, I will feel good about myself. So I wouldn't say it's something that... I guess the difficulty with the question is, it's not innate, but it's not exactly earned. Do you know what I mean?
It's... Yeah, and it's also not permanent, right? If you do discover some self-esteem...
Mm-hmm.
And you could still, you know, I don't, a simple example would be a depression. You go into depression for some reason, mm-hmm. you could simply lose your discovery of self-esteem and you have to rediscover it, right? So there's
I think that's if the self-esteem or self-worth is based on some extrinsic thing, like having a high quality job, and then you lose the job and you become depressed.
Well, do you think someone...
You're not thinking, I have value because I'm who I am and because I have these qualities that no one will be ever able to change. You're thinking, oh, I have value because I have a good paying job, right? And then when you lose the job...
You don't have value, so you're...
Yeah. Or you're thinking, I have value because I'm in a relationship. This person wants me. This person loves me.
Yeah.
This person wants to have sex with me. And then when you lose that person, since
another.
Your self-esteem was so dependent on that, you know, it's very depressing because you were basing your self-worth on somebody else.
And that has kind of a nasty slingshot effect, too, because most relationships do end.
You know?
Yes,
and
absolutely.
If you're, you know, attaching your self-worth to the fact that somebody else wants to be with you,
right.
It kind of leads to you being lazy and you not moving forward on your own and not, you know, pursuing your own purpose and your own goals and finding value in yourself for yourself. So when that person's, you know, like, well, you've been saying, God, you know, no matter how much I suck, this person loves me. when they're gone, you just suck, you know? I mean, as far as the feeling
yeah.
is concerned,
yeah, yeah,
as far
right.
as the feeling is concerned.
The irony is that you're kind of bringing on the end of that relationship with your attitude, because would you be attracted to someone who got lazy with their philosophy of life and with their desire to improve themselves?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Right.
And
no.
so and that's
it
what you're doing, so
desperate.
They're probably getting less and less attracted to you, and then they'll end, and then you feel worthless, so it's self-perpetuating.
I agree. So I think when we end school, or while we're coming out of school, our self-esteem is compromised in a lot of ways, whatever self-esteem we've been able to achieve. So then, with very little self-esteem, we're ready to start dating. So I think that gets us to that first, that people are malleable thing, because it seems like a lot of people, for one reason or another, for one factor or another, will settle. They will settle, and I'm so guilty of this in the past, you know, or trying to... put more value in certain aspects or certain attributes of that person to kind of not have to deal with
the
shortcomings where I know this, okay, this is not a good match.
But
let's focus on these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that because people might not feel so worthy of finding, you know, the right partner, they tend to settle on who's there, who's the same age, like you mentioned, I think, before. Mm-hmm. And then we're back to that first lesson. Let's get you changing into what I need you to be.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Much better said. Into what I need you to be.
I think people also learn learn terrible tactics of trying to change people in school. And by that I mean, if you know, I don't think it's really appropriate to try to majorly change people's intrinsic qualities in the context of a relationship. But, you know, if you want to persuade them to maybe...
rethink a philosophy or something.
Yeah, or I was thinking something along the lines of, you know, persuading someone to hang up their coat when they walk in the door instead of throwing it on the floor or something. Okay. You know, you can use the tactic of persuasion and try to get them to see why it's a good idea that they do that. And, you know, maybe they will do it and maybe they won't. But the tactics of changing people that are taught in school are force.
Detention.
Yes, if you don't do this, if you don't obey, something bad will happen to you that is unpleasant for you. Right? Do you think some people use those... I mean, obviously you can't give someone detention in the context of a relationship, but you can...
Time out.
But no, you can withdraw emotionally from them.
Yeah.
You can withhold sex. You can do all kinds of other mean... You can yell at them.
Mm-hmm.
You can physically hit them. Yeah. I mean, those are the kinds of unhealthy tactics that I see as basically being taught and reinforced in school.
Yeah. Because I did, you know, and I have had interactions in relationships with people that I was in serious relationships with that kind of felt like, you know, a meeting with the guidance counselor or maybe a performance review at work. Like, these are the things that you're not doing well. And then that escalates to disciplinary action, the kinds of things that you're talking about. I think that that's pretty common. And I think that in many ways, the encouragement, for lack of a better word, for the other person to change can often come in the form of manipulation. Mm-hmm. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, but I think that's what you're referring to, right? Negative ways to try and change someone?
But subtle. Manipulation in particular, yes. I'm trying to think of a way to, like, formulate my thought about that. But what were you thinking, Brett?
Well, I think a lot of times, that sometimes it is very explicit. Like, you need to do these things. Or there are these... Usually, mm-hmm. the reason why it escalates to, you know, some really negative types of interactions is because of the second lesson that we'll get to soon. so things are not being caught. Things are not being addressed. And then they escalate into these real fights or these real showdowns. But I think a lot of times it's more subtle. It's... people can be manipulative as far as how they are trying to tweak or encourage behavior in their partner.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example? Any examples of that? Manipulative?
Let's see. What would we...
I mean, I'm sure... I know there are some. That's what I was trying to think of before. Like, a really good example that illustrates that kind of manipulation in a relationship.
Well, if you want... another person to change.
Mm-hmm.
If you want, like, say I have a girlfriend and I want her to be more interested in something that I've really taken an interest in, we'll say.
Uh-huh.
So I identify, now I've identified this problem as something that I've done in the past and I wouldn't do it in the future.
Uh-huh.
I find something that's important to her.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn it and then throw in the guilt.
We start barter. It's not really even a barter, is it? No, it's more of a bribe.
It's like, do you do it ahead of time or after? Like, well, you know, I spent all this time learning your thing.
Oh,
you,
no. You do it before.
Oh, okay.
You're proactive. So you say, oh, you know, I really am just so thrilled to see how happy you are by me doing this. Now, whether it's about buying me more personal time,
right?
Where if I'm at home and I have things to do for work, I can expect to work for a certain amount of time uninterrupted.
Right.
These are real examples from the past.
Right.
So if I do this thing, does that buy me 90 minutes
right.
of time to myself? Now, I'm not saying that this isn't all kinds of screwed up, this kind of thinking, because this is manipulative.
Yep.
And this is trying to maybe even guilt the other person into saying, wow, you know, I should really follow Brett's lead here and care more about what he wants. But I wouldn't have been doing these things in the past because I really, really just wanted to see that person's satisfaction from that. I was doing it because I expected it to be reciprocated.
Yeah, I think when you said that example, Brett, it solidified it in my mind. And I was thinking, you know, it wouldn't have been bad if you had said to your girlfriend, hey, you know, I really need to get this work done. How about if I just take a couple minutes and go into my office and finish this up, and then afterwards we can spend some time together.
Mm-hmm.
What was bad was that you never explicitly said that to her. You were saying, well, I can get her to do this. I can make her do this in this way if I just kind of, twist it around like this and make her feel guilty and use the guilt to make her behave in a certain way.
Right.
So I think what we're talking about is the malleability of other people, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious, do you think this tactic of manipulation is learned in school?
That's an interesting question.
I think it's learned from other kids. I mean, maybe not specifically from teachers, but, people say commonly girls can be mean, right? Like middle school, high school age girls are notorious for being mean. I think boys can be mean too. I think all kids can be mean.
But they're
experts at manipulation.
And I really think that this is something, honestly, that is learned from parents.
The manipulation?
I really think so, because I think that if a child does start to express emotions or desires that are in conflict with the agenda that a parent or any authority figure has set forward, they're going to try and reframe it as, well, I'm actually really good and you're kind of bad. I mean, it's not going to be a conversation like that, but it's going to be a very, very subtle
manipulation.
Yeah, very, very subtle manipulation that's going to send that message. Well, you see, I'm really actually the one who's, doing the right thing, and you should kind of be like, you should feel guilty about even bringing that up. Yeah. Or trying to address that. I think parents are very good at that. I think that continues right into adulthood. If we continue to try and improve relationships, maybe not just with parents, but with family members, with siblings, or outside of family entirely. People want to reframe it as, well, I'm actually the one who's good. Mm-hmm. Like, no one ever says, yeah, I'm an asshole. I'm just, you got me. I was hoping I could get away with it for just a little bit longer. No, they're probably going to try and reframe whatever they're doing. They're going to try to attach some kind of virtue to that. So
I think kids learn how to manipulate their parents from a very early age too.
Because they
learn that they can't express certain things, right? They can't be honest with their parents, an example later in like maybe teenage years would be a kid can't really say to his parents, hey, Mom, I want to go out and get drunk tonight, so can you give me your car keys or whatever?
Okay, keep going with this example.
But they can try to manipulate the parent and say, oh, you need to let me do this. I don't know what they would exactly say.
Oh, you're saying they could try throw some guilt on the parent. Like,
yeah.
I'm 17, you want me to learn how to drive so I can get a job, so give me the car keys.
Yeah, they can't be honest. They have to sort of twist it around. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. But
at 17 or as a teenager, they're not learning manipulation.
No, but they've learned it their whole lives. Like when a little kid says to their mom for the first time, I hate you, or they say I love you because they want some piece of candy or something. You know, that's when it kind of starts.
Yeah, manipulation.
It might be pretty transparent then too, but it's in the learning process.
Sure.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
I was thinking manipulation could start to be learned far younger than that. Like, and I don't know if this is good or bad or even true or false.
When a baby looks cute to get something.
Well, no, I was going
to
say crying. No, when a baby cries, it's because they're unhappy and they get something. But when they're a little bit older, right, they can't speak, they don't have concepts yet. But when they get to be a little older, 2 or 1 year old, and when they cry, they notice they get what they want, or at least they get something, food or whatever it is.
Sure.
Maybe they'll start to cry when they don't want it just to get the attention or just to get the parent asking what they want. And that's manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. And manipulation is also tied to self-esteem. It really is. Because if you think about, we have 5 senses, and we've always heard stories about how if people lose a sense, right? Like, if people are blind, the ears pick that up. The ears work overtime to compensate.
Okay.
If people feel like they have absolutely nothing to offer anybody else, those are the people who tend to be the most manipulative. Agree, disagree? I mean, that's...
Yeah, because they have nothing to trade to get what they want. They have no bartering position, no leverage, because they feel they have nothing, because of no self-esteem. Is that what you mean? I'm not worth your doing this for me, so I'm going to have to manipulate you into
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Like, I bring nothing to the table.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that in what turns into a lot of relationships, and I just, like, this is my past of going to college and being in this environment. The first and most basic is sex. I'm going to throw some sex at you, right? Because there's, you know, there's not much, but I want you to be interested in me, and there's not much to me, but let's focus on these parts of
that
me.
That could very well be.
Let's focus on
everyone
these parts.
Has sex. I mean, everyone has that to offer.
Yeah.
Even if they...
Sexuality.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Even if they feel they have no self-esteem and no worth, they have a body that can be used for sex, so that's... Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be thrown out there.
And, you know, that was a big part of my drive with my interactions with women was sex. And, you know, it's like I cringe to think about myself 10 years ago and just how scummy I was as, like, you know, a college male, but typical in that environment.
Yep.
And it would just be like, let's have as much sex as possible. And if we find somebody who's tolerable based on just beyond these basic physical requirements, then what we might call that dating. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that was like really surrounding myself and putting myself in situations with a lot of people who I felt fit that mold, that they were very willing to throw the sex thing out there very, very quickly. And then if it did turn into anything more than that, the sex would be kind of pulled back and the manipulation would be cranked up.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know what you're saying.
So how happy were you during this period?
Not happy at all. Now, of course, we think that this is the entire goal at that age. And I don't want to say we, like everybody, but
generally,
when I was a 19 or 20-year-old male, I would have been described as a womanizer, pretty much. Having a very misogynistic attitude, a very unequal attitude about men and women, like really kind of not healthy thinking about it at all. And of course, you know, certainly a lot of regret comes with that. But when I look back at that time, it was extremely empty. It was an extremely empty time in my life because there was no real relationships.
Right.
Not even with, I mean, even like friends in high school,
because,
in college.
Because they were like you. You were surrounding yourself with you.
What did we have to offer
each
other?
Right. All we did was,
high five for the sex you had last night.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you know, our conquests, and then we'll drink, and then we'll get high, and then we'll play PlayStation, and then we'll pick on each other, and we'll call it a friggin' friendship.
Wow.
You know? I mean, but that was, that is very, very typical of, I think, at least male relationships at that age.
And think about it from the other side of the women who are going around thinking, well, I don't have very much self-esteem, so I'm going to throw a bunch of sex out there.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody picks up on it, yay, they want me. That means I'm good. Mm-hmm. That means I'm great. And then when they dump me, it's the lowest
it's
low
worst.
Because now they've rejected the one thing that I had to offer.
Yeah, you know? So it's that extra hurt where... I don't even need to restate that. The one thing that I'm throwing out
wasn't
good enough. Exactly.
So basically, the norm we're talking about, not everybody, but the norm is very shallow, meaningless relationships, sexual relationships.
And friendships.
And shallow friendships, right.
Quote-unquote friendships, yeah.
So I was...
Dependencies... Low self-esteem. Yeah. Wow, it sounds like an apocalypse.
Yeah.
Or like I said when I first made this list, the perfect storm of school lessons that lead to the just failures and horrors in relationships as adults.
Yeah. So what about conformity? Is that where you were going next, Brett?
Well, I think that conformity is certainly a part of it, but there are expectations that we will be obedient and that we will conform in school and in family, but we can focus on school, that... There isn't really much of a forum for us to, like, express feelings and emotions when we're growing up.
Nobody
is asking us for feedback. So by the time we become adults, now this is number two. Number one was people are easy to change. Number two is we don't have any practice expressing our emotions by the time we become adults in any real significant, meaningful way. Now, relationships require... some damn good communication to survive, right? But we don't have any real practice at doing that in an honest, genuine, constructive way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And most people being able to communicate feelings and expectations and ideas and exchange
desires.
Values requires being able to identify them within oneself mm-hmm. and to be able to own feeling a certain way and to recognize, hey, I feel this way
and
when
accept,
this happens
yeah.
And accept that. But most people, I think, have trouble even getting to that first step of realizing how they feel. You know, they may feel angry, but they can't identify why, and then they explode for some reason. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Communication is often swapped out for having emotions at people
mm-hmm.
instead. Mm-hmm. Because you're right, exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
Mike, you're having such
I'm
a thought
processing.
Right now.
No.
Is it not ready?
Just
is
processing,
it
not ready.
It's baking in his brain.
I have nothing to offer.
You're going to throw some sex at the audience.
If only it were a video
Watch
podcast.
Out, Doc!
Yeah.
No, but it's true. I mean, people can't really even process their own emotions oftentimes. And so, you know, translating that to getting along with a partner, you know, they often use a lot of one of the communication techniques that a lot of people say, like communication coaches, is to use I statements. Well, I feel this
that,
way.
Yeah.
I think this. But a lot of people communicate using you. You make me so mad. You did this to me.
You need to.
Why did you do this?
So they're kind of attaching their conclusion to it. They're not just saying, I want you to know how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's I want you to know how you are making me feel.
Yes, and they're not owning control over their
right,
own emotions.
Right, because no one can make you feel.
Yeah.
They're projecting, really, is what
yeah.
they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So instead of, like, having open dialogue, you're just shifting to, like I said, having emotions at people. You're not expressing an idea to another person in a constructive way. You're putting the other person on the defensive
mm-hmm.
immediately, which is where communication pretty much shuts down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think often people are seeking the gratification of just getting out that emotion
mm-hmm.
and expressing that emotion because they aren't allowed to do that in a normal context, or they don't feel that they can do that, instead of gearing their communication at solving a problem. They're just trying to vomit out all this emotion instead of constructively trying to reach mm-hmm. a goal or define a goal or solve a problem, you know?
And if they've been letting it build for a while, guess what's coming with it when it finally comes out? A whole bunch of resentment.
Yeah.
You know? So now it's about, I might like to be a little bit hurtful here.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that goes back to manipulation, too. People in relationships learn how to press each other's buttons and learn how to hurt each other. And then they pull out those weapons, you know, when they have these emotions that they just can't communicate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or when they feel hurt themselves, their immediate reaction is to say, I want to hurt back.
Yeah,
right?
Let's bring everybody to the same level.
Mm-hmm. So in school, you're taught, or they teach, you know, history and math and biology and, I don't know, what economics, I guess, and what else?
I don't know. Economics? Where did
no.
you
know? I'm old.
That?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, the place would be shut down immediately.
No, they don't. I don't say
they teach
you, real economics.
Yeah.
Economics means
Wall
like
Street
learning
economics.
How to write, make out a check.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Right. What's the change?
But they don't. Not only does government school not teach relationships and expression and communication and emotion, but they harbor an atmosphere where it's bad, right?
Yeah.
So they don't actively talk about it and teach it, and in all the other stuff that they do, it's a negative environment for expressing your emotions and having relationships.
Sure, and a kid who expresses frustration, boredom, anger, maybe in the most, you know,
detention,
negative
held back
way.
A grade.
Yeah, or drugged, as Brett
drugged,
was saying,
hell yeah.
one of his recent shows, you
yeah.
know. Kids who express their frustration and boredom, maybe
wow.
not that constructively, but they're expressing something there, right? When they can't sit still, when the teacher's droning on about something,
mm-hmm.
when they're making paper airplanes and, you know, pulling people's hair and stuff like
Class
that.
Class clown.
They're saying, yeah. get me the heck out of here. I'm so bored. I'm so frustrated. And nobody recognizes that. They just want to medicate it away, or they want to send the kid out of the room so they don't, you know, they don't want to deal with what's causing that.
So, which is them.
Right. Yeah.
And so if the result of boredom, of just subtle, relatively subtle expressions of boredom or disapproval are met with being drugged, right? Yeah. Imagine now if that same kid says, okay, this is how I express boredom. Now I'd like to talk to you all about my feelings
right.
and the emotions and the reactions, the personal reaction that I'm having to this environment. If there's no forum for that. And kids know that, and that shut down very quickly. So just as I was saying, by the time it finally pops out, it's like a punishable mm-hmm. offense.
Yeah.
The same thing happens when it's in a relationship as an adult. When it's finally forced through, when this you know, it's just the pressure can't hold back anymore, and it just bursts through. It has all that resentment with it. So people tend to think that, well, I better hide this stuff. I better tuck this stuff away.
I better drink a lot and
yeah.
I better take some drugs like they gave me in school.
Yeah, right. Medicate myself. Yeah.
Nasty.
So wait, I have a question.
Sure.
How could, if there are kids listening to this stuff and they say, man, I feel this exact same way. I feel like nobody will listen to how I feel and nobody will listen to my frustrations. Like, what can they do? How can they actually express those feelings? How can they start to
analyze
how they feel and then figure out what to do about it?
Actually, ironically, they are already analyzing how they feel by asking that question. But what can they do about it is mm-hmm. the question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think they're not going to be able to look to anybody else around them, really. I
mean, not in the normal
tough.
Society.
Right. You know, I mean, that's really tough, too, because, you know, one of the goals of this show in giving it such a, you know, an in-your-face kind of title was, like, you have this written on your notebook, right?
Yeah,
you mumble this to yourself every day. You say this to your friends. I'd like to show you how true it is. And I'd like you to see that there is support. That you are not alone in these feelings. So at least there's this guy who has experience working in this system, working in these environments, who went through this himself. At least there's now a community here. And it's not just what we're doing. There's a great site called schoolsurvival.net that covers a lot of this stuff. Kids themselves have done a great job on YouTube of, you know, expressing. I mean, you put school socks into YouTube,
yeah.
you won't find me for a while. It's mostly like these 13-year-old kids.
Yeah.
And even the totally awesome High School Sucks the Musical, which
really?
Is like a take on High School Musical. Uh-huh. I don't know if it's a whole movie, but the opening number is a video on YouTube, and it's brilliant. It's
nice.
Beautiful.
Cool.
So to just be part of being able, for me anyway, was to be able to be part of saying, all right, you're not alone in this stuff. But you are going to have to, in a lot of ways, you are going to be alone in this stuff, with yourself, and kind of discovering who that is, and accepting it. And I think that looking, when the question is, what can we do? Well, it is that process of self-discovery. And if it's what can we do, what can other people do for me?
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know.
Right.
And that was one of the things, you know, I was out in Keene, they were doing their school sucks activism
mm-hmm.
last year. And when I heard they moved to the middle school, I mean, I'm totally supportive of anything they do, and I think it's great and courageous, and it needs to be done. But when they first moved from the high school to the middle school, I thought to myself, is that really a good idea to take this to the middle school?
Hmm.
Because those kids, if they realize this stuff now, they're so stuck, you know, right there. And what are they going to do? But then I realized when I was working with a lot of middle school kids at the time, and when I saw how they were just kind of drudging through their lives, and they just look so sad and miserable and all hunched over like little old, like these 13-year-old little old men and women, just completely miserable. I said, yeah, this is something that they should be made aware of this. They should know that this is not their entire life, filling out worksheets, if mm-hmm. they don't want it to be. So, I mean, is that an acceptable answer to that question, if
sure.
I answered it at all?
It's a very tough question, but yeah, I think it is kind of an acceptable answer, just kind of gaining the self-awareness to know that this is not the end-all be-all. It's not going to be like this forever. There are some things, you know, you can find some community, you can search within yourself, mm-hmm. to find self-esteem and to realize that
you can search for the community.
Yeah.
Technology that's making this world smaller will help.
Yes.
But Stephanie, you said earlier that it was important to own your feelings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And That's...
I don't know how I feel about that. No.
Really?
No.
Oh.
I'm just kidding.
You got me. that's kind of... Maybe that's the message that someone... That a young person just realizing this information that we're talking about needs to know, that they have to own this. Yet, there are some people in the world who feel the same and who can sympathize and who can empathize and who can talk to. And like Brett said, you are going to be alone in some of these things, so you just got to own that you are who you are. You're a good person, and you're going to get through this, and you're going to... The world... let's see. The world only holds you down so long, and then it expects you to be trained to stay down. But if you can hold on to who you are until that point, you don't have to stay down when they're no longer holding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. And it's okay to feel that way. And there is growth there's growth that comes from feeling feelings. Like I was saying to you guys, I ended a relationship that was a long relationship. It was the first person that I ever thought about marrying, even though I'm totally against that idea.
Right.
It's stupid. But, that ended 3 months ago. And still, even to this day, even with all this stuff, these thoughts will pop into my mind and I'll say, get that thought out of there.
Hmm.
You know, but then it's like, no, feel that. Experience that, understand what that is, because there's, you know, it's like the tip of an iceberg, maybe. And by feeling those things, we can learn a lot, about ourselves. It's not good to run away from that stuff.
No.
Right?
It'll keep surfacing if you run away
right.
from it.
Yeah. You know? And then worse and worse, right?
Yeah.
And that goes back to what this whole second lesson is that we're talking about, where it's like emotions, why do you have those? Push those down.
Yeah.
Other people don't have those. Other people are just kind of going along with the assembly line here. So... Any other thoughts on that one? We can move to the third?
I think we can move to the third.
Yeah.
All right. We are trained in school to pay attention to words and not deeds. So the example that I gave just to...
More irony.
The way we learn history. We look at what Jefferson wrote. And then that's attached to everything that anyone in power in the United States ever did. But that's not true.
Nope.
Right? So... We, even in the political rhetoric of campaigns today, people just make crap up. They just say
amazing.
Stuff that isn't even true. And like, here, just focus on the words.
Yeah.
Don't look at my record. And it's one of the reasons why, not that I want to get into this like awful political topic, but senators can't be elected president because people have a record of their deeds. Very clearly.
Oh.
How did you vote on this? How did you vote on this? You can see who a person is politically. So they can't just make a bunch of shit up. They have to really completely lost...
They have to... They're what they say and what they do have to be more in sync than someone who doesn't have that very public history.
Right. So if they can't hide their public history, they people see, even the American voters will see through, like, you're
something.
Full
yes.
of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the school itself, how is the school itself words and not deeds?
Yeah, that's what I was saying about irony, because the school will teach you, this is the freest country in the world, and you are free, and we're all individuals, and then they act to create conformity. And
they treat you as though you're in jail.
You are in jail. You're not free to leave if you don't want
their
message. You're not
free
to question their message.
No,
it's opposites.
If you want to do anything, you have to ask their permission.
Like pee,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Or
wow.
even speak.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's just
you
amazing.
Don't speak unless you raise your hand and the teacher allows you to speak. I mean, just think about that. I mean, those two things: the fact that schools want the kids to ask to go to the bathroom and ask to speak. both can be denied. What can you actually do without asking permission?
Can I take in a breath now?
Yeah. I know, I was just about to say.
Oh, sorry.
No, you made a great point. It's true. I mean, just imagine how that impacts someone's self-esteem.
Yeah.
I can't decide for myself when to do the most basic human function of using the bathroom.
Right.
Or verbalizing
a thought.
Or
I'm not worthy of deciding, right.
I mean, you can have thoughts in your heads, but you can't actually express those thoughts or verbalize them without having someone else give you the okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so sick. I mean...
That is, government runs the schools, and the schools teach people to be like this, and that's, you know, it's self perpetrating or self perpetuating again, because because the government needs the people to need the government in order to exist, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Yep.
And if you are trained to think that you need authority to tell you when to pee, as a, you know, as a metaphor, then you're going to need government. You need government to tell you how to, you know, how much money to pay the government. You need government to tell you what's good to eat.
Oh, I could never possibly start a business, or I could never possibly plan for my own retirement, or I could never possibly decide how to take care of my body without the government.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
And the sad thing is that kind of links back to school, because after 12 years of that, a lot of people can't.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Why, which is why I say
right
that
out of them.
School is the thing that needs to go first. And we look at the dissolution of the state or the government, as far as I'm concerned anyway, even though I would love to see that happen before I die, I understand that it's probably a multi-generational mm-hmm. endeavor mm-hmm. because as long as people are being educated by the government, there's, you know, we look crazy.
Yes, yeah.
Which is weird.
And we have to spend time undoing all of this damage, this psychological damage, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're really striking at the root, Brett. You're right. Another way that schools are words and not deeds, that you said before the show, Brett, is the fact of how schools are funded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they teach people, okay, force is wrong, right? Bobby, you're not supposed to hit little Jimmy, even though they do all the time. You know, kids get into fights all the mm-hmm. time. And teachers, you know, may forcefully grab kids and take them out of the class and stuff like that.
Hell, it's a threat of force that keeps them in class.
Right.
Yeah, and in some cases, it's still, you know, teachers can still hit kids, physically hit them.
Yeah.
Or spank them or something. and, you know, despite that, you know, the kids are taught that using force is wrong. But yet, the entire school is funded by force.
The entire school system.
Everyone who lives anywhere, basically, unless I guess you live in an RV or something like that.
Or tent, or teepee. Or
I mean,
everybody
is everybody who has kids or not, who has kids that are going to school or not,
who
wants to pay for it or not,
stopped, right.
You know, regardless of how they feel about it, regardless of where they live, they are forced to pay for somebody's kids' education.
I live in a town that doesn't have a school, and I pay part of the property taxes is for school.
Wow.
It's ridiculous.
Wow.
Well, maybe someday.
Maybe once they collect
maybe someday,
them. Maybe
be a
they need to raise those taxes
in your town.
To build a school.
And you can proudly watch as they march the children in there and say the yellow bus is pulling up, and you can say, I helped.
Wow. Oh, joy.
It's a really good point, Stephanie.
Yeah. Think,
it was your point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Own it.
But, I mean, at every, yeah, it's. We are taught that we should play nice, and we shouldn't take other people's stuff,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly shouldn't hurt other people.
No.
Share and share alike.
Right. But if people are not able to take our stuff, like if we put any resistance up as far as the whole school funding scheme is concerned, eventually someone's coming to hurt us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And take more of our stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we learn in kindergarten, don't hurt other people, don't take their stuff, and tell the truth. And the fact that people tolerate those two things happening is just built on a mountain of lies to even make that possible. So, I mean, we learn that, you know, triad of ethics, and then we spend the next 12 years, we learn that in kindergarten, and then we spend the next 12 years learning to worship an institution that has to break all three of those rules every day
mm-hmm.
just to continue existing. That's words, not deeds. Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
So how's that translate to adult
relationships?
Well, words, not deeds. I mean, just, Brett, what you were saying about, you know, the typical college male, mm-hmm. right? Or, I mean, this could certainly translate to anybody, not just males, but I'm thinking of pickup artists, you know?
Mm.
Like, I'm, you know, the words that they say are, you know, listen to me, like me, I'll make you feel great, I'm a good person, when their deeds say, I'm going to get something that I want from you and then drop you like a used tissue, right?
Mm-hmm. Good metaphor.
I mean, is that words versus deeds? What about in relationships when people promise things but don't deliver on their promises? Like, I'm thinking of long-term relationships.
Or how about, I promise to love you forever?
Yeah, I promise
that's
to love
words
you forever.
That you cannot possibly.
Most marriages, isn't it the majority of yeah. You know,
vows?
State marriages that yeah. people that are tracked in their statistics on these, right? Something on the order of half of them end in divorce, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And, you know, those people had promised to love each other forever, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health. When in reality, I mean, if you really think about that,
you can't.
How can you promise? How can you foresee the future? How can you promise right. to love someone forever?
Even
you
if it ends up happening, you couldn't have known it in advance. You cannot promise that you will love someone forever because people change. They might have been hit by a bus and put in a vegetative state. Do you still love them? You know, they might.
And I think you would, but it would be. It would drastically change your relationship. I mean, it's,
what if they lied to you this whole time and they weren't even who you thought they were? Do you promise yeah. to love them? Do you love them?
Yeah.
You can't promise that.
You love
that.
An idea of who someone yeah. is and not necessarily who they are.
Hmm. And I think that a lot of, well, I guess, you know, this might be a little bit more complex, but I remember in my initial investigations of how to improve relationships, like years ago, mm-hmm. when, I mean, I haven't been in many serious long-term relationships in my life. They're mostly very short-term,
mm-hmm.
kind of very quick, going back. But, you know, as I've matured and become an adult, I obviously have, you know, had a couple long-term relationships. And, you know, as I started to try and investigate how these relationships could be improved, and the best thing that could have been done is to, you know, stop fantasizing about what this person and I have together mm-hmm. based on whatever kind of interaction we had in the first few months we were together, which is very not mm-hmm. clear mm-hmm. as far as what's really there. But as I would trick myself into thinking they could be improved, you know, I started to investigate the different ways that men and women approach problems. And women, and this might not be true across the board, but this was my experience, women want to talk about problems, and maybe that's because they're more realistic about problems that can't be solved. Like, they say, I just want to throw this out there that this is a problem, mm-hmm. right? Now, a man who doesn't want to, maybe, it, from my experience anyway, doesn't want to deal with the problem, just says, well, I can fix that. Well, we can take care of that. But maybe, you know, a lot of the times the woman was saying, I don't know if this can be fixed,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, you would have to weigh in on that, I'm not sure. But I felt like it's more that women obviously want a resolution
mm-hmm.
to whatever the feeling is. But men seem to be more like, since I already kind of don't want to deal with this anyway, I will just say that I can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to be having this conversation because it only feels, because we're terrible communicators, honey. So really, what you're saying feels to me like I'm doing something wrong.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of want to just get this over with. So I'm going to tell you that I can fix it.
When I'm really just going to ignore it.
When I really just can't wait for the conversation to be over.
Yeah.
Now, I hate to admit it, but I've been there. Now, I wasn't like, I didn't want to be better. It wasn't like I wanted to be with a person who was unhappy with the things that I did. And I would even resign myself to saying, yeah, I can, that's easy to do. I can do that. But the most immediate thing was like, let's stop this conversation that makes me feel defective in this relationship. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. that's certainly words and not deeds. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of words thrown around like, I respect you. I appreciate you.
Mm-hmm.
I see the value in the things that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And probably more than any other,
I love you.
I love you.
That's the first thing that came to mind, but I didn't know how to put that into words. Like, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, some people do love other people. So,
yeah.
But oftentimes the actions don't match up to those
yeah.
things.
Yeah. As a matter of fact,
yeah.
there's someone involved in my life
mm-hmm.
Who claims to love someone, yet threatens them and goes out of their way to make their life miserable because the person doesn't love him back.
Mm-hmm.
And, mm-hmm. you know, he may very well love this person, by what he's been trained and grown up to think love is. But that's words, not deeds, in my mind. How can you possibly love someone if you try actively to hurt them?
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of confusion about what love is.
Mm.
But I think love is something... Love is a word that people assign to a person that they've been involved with for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. just, mm-hmm. well... I guess I love you now.
What is it? 3 months? My goodness, have I told you I loved you yet? Right.
In fact, there have even been times in my own past relationships where I've felt the emotion of love, but felt that I couldn't express it to the other person because it was too early in the relationship and they wouldn't take me seriously.
Interesting. That's the
I almost attached some time to it, like there was a clock on it that it would suddenly be meaningful if there was some arbitrary amount of time that had passed, you know.
Yeah.
And in reality, once that arbitrary amount of time passed, it hadn't changed my feelings, but I felt more comfortable saying it or whatever. I guess that's a tangent, but
I think that's a really important point that like it's just something that's so routine and programmed and expected
mm-hmm.
that and then. Ooh. Go ahead.
You're
more excited than I am.
I finally thought of an example of how I love you is a word, not a deed. And it really bugs me. You hear people all the time, you know, just you're walking through the grocery store and there's someone in the aisle and you hear them on the cell phone. Pick up some butter. Yeah, some milk. Yeah, okay, I'll do that. Okay, love you. Bye. I hate that.
Are they thinking about it?
I love you. They just said I love you in a shopping list.
That was my idea too.
Oh, it was great.
We thought of it at the same time.
Was it really?
Exactly.
That's amazing.
Yeah, because I was thinking like, you know, when it's not love anymore, when it's like, yeah, okay, love you, okay,
yeah.
love you.
Yeah.
Wait, what? All right, yeah, I love you. Bye. Where it just has been like this is the obligatory
end of phone.
Yeah, end of phone call.
Yeah, it means goodbye in that case. It doesn't
yeah.
mean.
Yeah, it's just that's a word and not a deed.
It means goodbye in more ways than one.
You might actually love the person. But what you're saying at the time is not expressing it. What you're saying is, I'm done with the phone call.
Yeah. Weird. How about the way that words and not deeds applies to the endings of relationships? Because I think ending relationships is something that a lot of people have trouble with. And the ways that poor communication and lack of self-confidence and other things manifest in the ends of relationships is really... interesting and important.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of people who just don't want to deal with ending relationships, and so they ignore. You know, they do the disappearing act.
Hmm.
What is the disappearing act?
They stop calling, stop talking to their partner, pull back from them emotionally, but don't just say, we need to end this relationship, or I want to break up with you, or something like that.
Yeah.
Their words are saying, I still want to be with you, or their words are not saying anything, but their deeds are saying, get away from me, I'm not interested.
Or I'm running away from you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can do the disappearing, and again, I know this from experience, you can do the disappearing act when you live in the same house with that person.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was telling you guys when we were talking that, like, when I started exploring these topics, and I read the book Real Time Relationships, and I got, you know, 40, 50 pages through it, and I shut it. And I said, and this was, you know, 6, 7, 8 months ago, and I said, I'm not ready to read this book. I'm not ready to face this. And then when I finally picked it up and read it, I was 80, 90 pages into it, and I said, the relationship I'm in is over, you know? And then, but it was very much that kind of distancing,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it was things like, we should read this book, or we should do something. As almost kind of like to say, if you don't want to do this, it's confirmation for me.
Mm-hmm.
That it's over.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And then it just kind of...
This is kind of tangential, but I'm curious. 8 or 9 months ago, when you first read 50 pages, then shut it, did you explicitly think, I'm not ready for this? Or you just kind of put it down and told yourself, I'm bored with this book, and you now realize...
Oh, yeah, at the time, yeah, you're absolutely right. Because I said, oh, I should get back to that. Now I remember reading it and feeling really uncomfortable.
But not knowing...
some of the things
that
I read.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, relationships... that start with a whole bunch of sex,
mm-hmm.
that means, you know, not much sex later on, because it's like there's going to be some resentment about if that's the only thing that I have to offer. Like, I feel like that's the only thing that I have to offer. Like, from the woman's point of view, if she feels that way, yeah, that's coming out, you know, in high volume at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But then maybe 3 months later, it's like, well, what is this all about?
Right.
And he's telling these stories in the book that are conversations that I had had.
Yeah.
You know? And really, kind of with everything that I had invested in the relationship at the time, I said, I need to find some other way to really try and improve this. And really denied then that this was going to end. And then when I picked it up and read it all the way through, I was halfway through when I knew it was over.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this is not a good relationship. Even though this person is wonderful and beautiful and funny and nice and we get along, that doesn't make it, that's not enough to make it the kind of relationship that we both were tricking ourselves into thinking that we had. So, but what you said was absolutely right. Yeah, I didn't admit that at first. But, yeah, that disappearing act happens when the two people are passing each other. You know, eventually just like ghosts in the same house.
That's definitely words, not deeds, because you're... Words are, we live together, we're in a relationship, we're in love, whatever, and your deeds are fading away, ignoring, separating.
Not even friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about the way that some people misrepresent themselves at the very beginning of relationships?
Oh, wow.
I'm thinking of, for instance, you know, Brett, as you said, relationships that start off with a lot of sex.
Mm-hmm.
When that's not really what the partner wants, right? They don't want to be having sex all the time. They just figure to hook you, to get you, that's what they have to do. And so they do it. Or what about people who put up dating ads and they say stuff like, I'm 3 inches taller than I actually am and I earn $50,000 a year more and I, you know, I'm like this, when they're really not like that. And they try to create this, I don't know, they try to weave this story of who they are based on who they want to be,
mm-hmm.
when that's not really who they are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There are, like, I think there's ways to pick that stuff up when two people are sort of courting each other mm-hmm. and being sort of careful about how they're doing it at first. When sex is thrown into the mix too soon, you, for some reason, you don't want to, like, just... pay any attention to the red flags that are landing all around you, that are flapping in your face, right? You don't want to pay any attention to that stuff because you're high on sex. But I think, yeah, people do misrepresent themselves in relationships, and that's probably the most common way. Now, I think that's more coming from women towards men. The sex
women
part.
Misrepresenting themselves?
Because men wouldn't take a woman out on a date and say, you know, we're going to have sex every day for the next... like, most... I think... that would be awkward and unnatural for a man to say, hey, we're going to go home tonight and have sex, and then for the next 30 days, we're just going to be having sex. Right? Like, that's something that really, I think, the woman initiates originally, that's just at least to send that vibe.
It could be. I mean, but maybe the tactics differ, but the misrepresentation is still there.
From both sides.
From both sides.
Yeah, because there's two participants. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And for instance, you know, maybe with some men, it's... they pretend to listen more, right? Because they think that women want listening.
Right.
Oh, right.
They pretend to care.
Yeah. Or they pretend to ask more questions, or they actually do ask more questions because they're more interested at the beginning and then they lose interest or something. I don't know. But I think I think everyone, to a certain extent, misrepresents themselves. It reminds me, we've talked about this on the show before, Mike.
How to meet people?
No, I'm thinking of the one about lying.
Uh-huh.
I had a professor in college who studied lying, a psychology professor, and he did a study that ended up becoming rather famous in, like, the pop media. And the study was, he took male and female hetero college students and matched them up with each other, who, like, people who had never met. And then he put them in a room and asked them to chat for like 5 minutes and introduce themselves. And then he asked them later on when they were alone, okay, well, let's go through the video of everything that you said about yourself. Was this true? Was this true? Was that true? And on average, a third of what everyone said was a lie.
Wow.
Both genders. I mean, it was college students, so, you know, they're at the age where maybe they don't feel... I don't know, maybe the age has something to do with their level of confidence in themselves, mm-hmm. but they felt the need to misrepresent themselves to a opposite gender student their age that might have been a potential dating partner, I guess, 30% of the time. And, you know, some people were totally honest, of course, but that means some people were lying 2/3 of the time.
Well, how much do they value integrity? And how much do they really even know who they are? Right?
Yep.
If you think about college, I mean, you're still pretty full of that poison, you know?
Sure.
And I mean, most people are for the rest of their, you know, for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But at that age, where part of that, the goal of that environment is, you know, sexual interaction mm-hmm. with other people, especially, I mean, my experience anyway, then that's going to be a higher priority than mm-hmm. personal integrity.
Sure.
Especially when most of those people don't even consider the concept of integrity, and even if they did, they wouldn't know how to exercise it because they barely even know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've found, too, that in meeting new people, they if they're not completely misrepresenting themselves, they'll say, like, I've always considered myself to, you know, kind of, I have a lot of different interests, and, you know, I'd like to try this, and I'd like to try that. So I'll tell somebody, if I met somebody new, and I said, oh, these are the things that I'm into right now. Like, I like racquetball,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, not something most people are into. And you start like listing, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, we should play it.
I haven't played in years, but I like this sport. But anyway.
At this point. But, you know, you list off things that you have as hobbies, and you don't really see anything on the other person's end. And they say, oh, I'll try that. I'll do that. I always wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That kind of thing.
Yep.
My best story that I will tell you guys that just this that made me think of. About 4 years ago, I was on MySpace. And for kids, there used to be a website called MySpace. It was kind of like
back
Facebook.
Back in the dark ages.
You can put it into the URL and go there. It's just basically an abandoned amusement park now. It used to be. It was a good way to meet people years ago. So about 4 years ago on MySpace, this girl wrote to me who lived in Derry, and I lived on the seacoast at the time. So just for the people in other countries, that's like, you know, 30 miles, a dateable distance. And we talked. And there she said, she wrote to me and she said, you know, you look like the kind of guy that I would like to go out on a date with, kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
right? With her own touches. So I wound up, we talked, you know, on there back and forth for a while. We talked on the phone a couple times. I said, oh, go out on a date with you. Sure. So I went and met her, and she was a lovely girl and very nice. And halfway through dinner, she tells me that she's a born again Christian.
Hmm.
Oh.
So I said, all right, this is our last date, so, you know, let's try to have a good time. But that's like the kind of, you have to be upfront. I mean,
yes.
Like, that's, I have to think even born-again Christians know that that's kind of like, I wouldn't tell somebody 3 or 4 dates in that, like, oh, you know, like, I'm basically what most people would call an anarchist. Right? And I'm an atheist. And, you know, these are my views about...
You wouldn't, or you would tell them?
No. I would want to wait till the...
Right,
you know,
right,
right. Right. I wouldn't want to have anybody throwing eggs in my basket, you know, until they knew that about me.
Or just wasting your own time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because once they... Because, like, I'm just denying that that's not going to be, like...
That's extremely important.
I've had 4 phone conversations with you, so at this point, I know you're such a special guy that I will totally... tolerate your, even though I have an Obama bumper sticker on my car. Yeah, that's cool. I can adapt to that.
You can change
probably,
them.
You could probably change me, Brett. You could probably make me into whatever you need.
Oh, God.
So,
but also, how could you hide that stuff? I mean, it's so fundamental to who you are.
No,
you know?
Of course you could, because that's what misrepresentation is. You're saying, why would you?
No, how could you? I mean, I don't know. It just seems like it would be difficult to hide.
Well, you wouldn't see, but this part of the thing is that we're not really hiders. Like, once you kind of get this stuff and you understand the purpose of voluntary relationships and voluntary interactions, you're not going to try and bamboozle somebody else.
Or yourself. Right?
Yeah, or yourself. So it would be... Even I wouldn't even know how to try to hide who I was. You know what I mean? Because it would be so dishonest and so
futile,
right? And there's no integrity in that. And you're just asking somebody at some point to have like this this positive obligation, right? Where you say like, we don't believe in positive obligations. You don't have a right to education,
mm-hmm.
But in this interaction. Guess what? on our fourth date, you're going to find out that I have what you consider to be very radical political and religious views, and I'm going to expect you to accept that. So that's kind of like starting a relationship with a positive obligation, and mm-hmm. that's not something we would do. So I think you guys, what you do with your show is try to take these larger ideas and show how they would work on a personal level, right?
Yeah.
So that could never happen, I wouldn't think, unless somebody wasn't getting it.
Well, it could happen. Yeah. It just wouldn't be healthy and it wouldn't work out.
Yeah, yeah, sure, sure. Okay, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have nothing really to add.
Want to try and wind this down? Because I have one more thing I want to talk about.
Let's hit it.
Talk about it.
All right. I think as kids start to discover these ideas, that, well, I think it's important that they start to understand all of these things while in high school, about the state, about what's happening to them in school, about a lot of the aspects of their family, about the manipulation of authority figures, that if they really start to, you know, act, to accept this stuff and then act on this stuff, especially in their own personal lives, they're going to find, as I said to you guys at the beginning of the show, as I became single 4 months ago, and I realized, like, the last time I was single,
ladies,
I had a super, like, a very large dating pool, like a sea, you know, as they say.
A lot of fish in the sea, and
right.
Now...
Now that has narrowed down to...
Fishbowl.
A fishbowl.
Right. I'm laughing again at
because,
your misfortune.
Yeah, because, I mean, 3 or 4 years ago, I understood some of this stuff, but I didn't understand that it was something that you apply to your personal life, that you're free first. Yourself is free first, mm-hmm. and then you work on markets and states and worlds, right? But it's you start with yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I thought that these ideas, or I didn't realize, I guess, that these ideas were applicable to the personal life. So if you try to, you know, act with integrity and try to apply this stuff to your personal relationships, personal freedom, you might realize that what looked like a pretty decent-sized dating pool has shrunk considerably. Maybe not just the people who will, you know, want anything to do with you, but even the people, on the other hand, that you're willing
to do something with.
Yeah, that right. You're even willing to tolerate.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do we deal with that? What do you think?
A lot of in dating.
Well. Yeah, you hit on something, Mike. That's true. But, you know, I genuinely think that when you put your ideas out there and you're honest about them and you pursue interests that you have, you're going to find like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, maybe your dating pool is smaller, but your rate of success is much higher.
That's your percentage of success, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it seems to me like it's a matter of patience and some combination of patience and self-esteem, because your dating pool, or I don't like the term dating pool, but, you know, the people who you'll be interested in, the number of people greatly reduces, but those people, if you can find them, if you can have the patience to wait until you meet them and find them, will be so much more to
higher,
you.
Higher quality.
They'll mean more to you. They'll have the very important things to you in common. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I
before,
mean...
Your dating pool was vast, and because why?
Standards were lower.
Yeah, and everyone was in it.
Right? So and now like, you're looking for a woman who has very similar values, at least in some regards, right? And there are far fewer of those women, but when you find them, you will like them so much more than you liked any of them in the grand dating pool.
Right, so there you have it, folks. Like, reason and consistency and morality has already done, like, 95% of the work that Match.com will do for you.
At this point in our discussion, we started to have some technical difficulties with the recording, so we just agreed that we would do our own separate conclusion for each of our shows for School Socks and Pork Therapy. So I'm going to try and wrap this up in a relatively quick way. At the beginning of the show today, I played a clip from the movie Annie Hall, which is a Woody Allen movie. It came out in the late 70s, and it's the story of the rise and the fall, the arc of a relationship between a man and a woman. And it's really, even though Woody Allen is kind of unbearable as an actor, and from what I can tell as a person, he's a very good storyteller and a very good technical filmmaker, and he takes a lot of interesting chances in this film to tell the story the way he wants to tell it. So from an artistic standpoint, it's really worth checking out. And it's actually, if my fellow nerds can even believe this, it is actually the film that beat out Star Wars in 1977 for the Academy Award for Best Picture. So if you haven't seen it, check out Annie Hall. But I chose that clip that culminates with him approaching this couple on the street in this, panic and asking them how they make their relationship work. And I think that that's really important because a lot of people will make dating, will make relationships look very easy. Even though as far as real relationships, as far as meaningful relationships are concerned, they're impossible for the very same reasons. Right? People who don't know each other, and they never could know each other because they don't even know themselves, or there's nothing there to know, or they've never, ever even explored that. So at the end, we were talking about that. We were talking about this pursuit of self-knowledge and how that eventually leads to greater personal integrity. And while that allows you to narrow your focus as far as the people that you want to have in your life, romantic or otherwise, is concerned, I think it's a little bit disconcerting and it can be troublesome and frustrating when you realize that even though you've got that focus, the rest of the world is still going on all around you. And especially during adolescence, especially in high school, where embracing a lot of these ideas and acting on them might lead to isolation, but it can actually be a really positive thing. Because like I said, people all around you will make it look like romance and relationships are just super easy. And that's really not the case. It's very much like you're kind of observing, or you're in the middle, just this ongoing Halloween party where everyone's all costumed up. And, you know, if you walk into the middle of that party and you rip your costume off and you say, this is what I really look like, and I'm not ashamed of that. That really is like, as far as the party is concerned, that's really like the proverbial dick and the mashed potatoes. Party's over, for you anyway. You have to leave. You should not have done that. And on a personal note, in the last year, I certainly learned some difficult lessons about relationships and what kind of relationships will survive. You know, the transition from being able to live politely in mainstream society. These are the things that it's okay to talk about. These are the things that it's not okay to talk about in company. These are the issues that it's okay for a couple to explore. These are the things that should be avoided. To what I believe is a far more consistent and far more principled approach to my personal life and to my relationships. And I'm certainly not saying that the transition was easy or executed perfectly, and it's certainly an ongoing two steps forward, one step back kind of thing. And I hope I held my own feet to the fire on this. I hope people are satisfied. If you're not, let me know. But so many of our romantic relationships so often start with, I find you attractive, you find me attractive, I think you're very funny, you find me to be very pleasant company, so what we should be doing right now is having sex. In a couple months, we can talk about our goals. And then, like, 18 months after that, we can explore each other's values. And I'm really looking forward to that. I hope you have some. That's pretty backwards, but that's very typical. So when you start there, you're going to scare people. You're going to scare most people. And I think that that is an example of how narrow the focus really is as far as the kinds of people that you're willing to tolerate. And frankly, the kinds of people who will tolerate you. Because most people don't appreciate that stuff. Most people look a lot like cockroaches when somebody comes in to illuminate certain conversations or certain environments with consistency and with truth. It doesn't always go for, people don't go for that. You know, that's kind of a thread that's been running through several of the last shows. Like Erica and I talked about that. Steph and I talked about that. Gardner and I talked about that. Even Dr. Bruce Levine and I talked about that. And he said that that's something that's very common within the psychiatric community. There's no place for the truth. So I was warned a long time ago that if I went forward with a lot of this stuff and I tried to act on this stuff, that most of the relationships that, you know, I thought were real would blow away. And most of them did. And I guess, like I was saying before, that that can lead to feelings of loneliness. It can lead to frustration. But it's so important and so worth it. Because, yeah, I guess it can kind of suck to be lonely for companionship or lonely for other people or whatever. But those feelings sure beat the shit out of being lonely for ourselves. Trust me. Thank you for listening, and take care.